This program is made possible in part by KABU Foundation members and a grant from Cotton Cloud Futons, a locally owned business featuring futons and mattresses, frames, covers, furnishings, and accessories which can be made with organic and recycled materials. Cotton Cloud is located at 701 Northeast Broadway in Portland. Information at 503-335-0758 or cottoncloudfutons.com.
This KABU program... Excuse me, I'm reading the wrong script. This is KBOO Portland 90.7. It's time for the Tuesday Radio Zine. Thanks for joining us today. Coming up first on Between the Covers, host Jim Schumach interviews Kay Gibbs, author of The Life Around Me by Ellen Foster. At 9:30 on Words and Pictures, hear Dan Peraro, surrealistic painter, illustrator, and cartoonist. He's best known for his cartoon Bizarro. At 10, Terry Wiley of Oregon Tradeswomen discusses how that organization helps promote success for women in the trades. Also, Dan Denver of the Portland Central American Solidarity Committee talks about NAFTA-style free trade and immigrant rights. At 10:30 on stage and studio, members of Artist Repertory Theater discuss Assassins by Steve Sondheim. And at 11 on Democracy Now!, Antonia Juhas talks about her new book, The Bush Agenda, Invading the World, One Economy at a Time. And the director of a newly released film called The Peace Patriots talks about the activities of anti-war activists before and after the Iraq invasion. Now we go to Between the Covers.
These are the clouds of Michelangelo. Muscular with gods and sun gold. Shine on your witness.
This is Between the Covers. I'm Jim Schumach, and welcome. My guest today is novelist Kay Gibbs. Born in Rocky Mount, North Carolina, in 1960, she is the author of numerous novels, beginning with Ellen Foster, which was published when she was 26. Her current novel, a sequel to her first, entitled The Life All Around Me by Ellen Foster, has just been published by Harcourt. Welcome back to Between the Covers, Kay.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Did you have as tumultuous a childhood as those you've depicted in some of your works?
I did. Ellen Foster is autobiographical. And except for my grandmother not dying in my presence, so I didn't put flowers around her body from those show jars Ellen talks about. It's pretty true to the form back then. And recently, with all the hoopla with James Fry, I have been quizzed about that, you know, as though I, you know, should have written it as memoir. But when I wrote that book back then, I just thought of it as an autobiographical novel. And 20 years ago, one had to be Ben Franklin or even, you know, a Ted Turner or Robert McNamara or Margaret Mead. One had to have worked and achieved something, and, you know, you say, I want to share how I did this in order to write a memoir. They just weren't jotting down notes about stuff they went through. So it didn't occur to me to write a memoir. Now it does, but it's been done.
However, when I think about it, you know, a first memoir would have been unlikely to be published by an unknown then, don't you think?
Of course. Of course, now they're just being snapped up.
Right.
But so much has changed. I mean, I feel like I got into publishing before the days of free agentry. And my first novel sold for $1,500. And now, you know, that would be laughable. But I sold it to a publisher I trusted, and they did extremely well by it. So I never learned to associate writing with money the way that young people are now. And it taints the process, and it makes it all very ugly. But you're right. A memoir back then by an unknown would have been scoffed at. I think the first one you may know differently, The Liars Club.
Mary Carr, yeah. And I think then, that was the first current memoir that achieved a standard of fame.
I think, and then maybe Girl Interrupted.
Mm-hmm.
And I was trying to think of some other ones, but I remember when those books sort of burst on the scene. And it was very interesting that a person would peel back that curtain and disclose himself or herself without having that patina of fiction to cast doubt on the veracity of things, you know, and leave those readers guessing. And I never knew if it was brave or what's the word? I'm menopausal, so I have no words now. Voyeuristic, or a little of both, maybe.
Were you a voracious reader as a child?
Yes, I did. We had a bookmobile that came to the little country store near my house every Saturday. And as long as, and this is, Eudora Welty wrote about this, I think, in the Great Devouring, the book, the essay about reading that she wrote. As long as this librarian in the bookmobile couldn't see through your knees, if you were wearing, as she called them, a panty slip, and you were, you know, neat and your hair was combed neat, you could gain admission into her bookmobile and pick out your books. And you could only check out, I think, two, and you had to return them promptly. And I began back then to associate, I guess because of this woman's behavior, reading as sort of a holy enterprise and very special. And I would take the books back in the basket of my bike and read them and report them back to this woman and get more. And she never made me distinguish between genres, or she never corrected me away from Madame Bovary and said, you know, you have to read Louise May Alcott. So after I devoured, she calls it the sweet devouring. After I devoured Louise May Alcott, I just realized the world was right wide open and I could read anything I wanted to. And the woman just let me do it.
What was the first book that fully enthralled you, that drew you into its story and made it part of your own in a way?
It was Madame Bovary.
Really?
When I was, I think, 10. And what I realized was that I was reading about a very local place. And I began to wonder, and I can see myself sitting in my parents' living room. We only had four rooms in the house, so one of them was bound to be a living room. Sitting in that room, and it was very Spartan, wondering why this book lasted and why it was famous enough to have lasted all those years, and wondering how Flaubert got to my bookmobile, what made this different, and what kept this from being a throwaway book like I would see in the hospital waiting rooms when I would go and see my mother, the Leon Uris books. I remember those big books with the bright covers. Or the Harold Robbins back then, remember those?
The Carpetbagger.
Yes, all of those books. Or the Danielle Steele wasn't right, Jacqueline Suzanne, to decide what the difference between them was and how a story as regional as Madame Bovary had the traction to last. And once I figured that out, I knew I could become a writer. And I sort of kept it to myself for the next 20 or so years and then acted on it.
One thing I really like about Ellen is her use of the term compare and contrast.
Oh, I do too. Yeah, I do. It's one of my favorite things. Remember in school?
Absolutely.
You write a paper. I want you to talk about, you know, a separate piece and To Kill a Mockingbird, compare and contrast the point of view. And then she begins to apply that to everything in her life, and that's what gives it, you know, that edgy density. And now my editor uses it in her real life, so we'll be at the grocery store in New York, And she'll say, now compare and contrast that melon that we saw yesterday. So I love to sort of weave language like that into daily parlance.
Who in your life has been your most constant confidant?
I think my sister-in-law, Barbara, who took me in when I was 13, and she's the basis for New Mama in the books, and then Laura in the new book, and she's always, she doesn't necessarily approve of everything I do, but she has the great good grace not to tell me. And my children, and it's not meaning that I would ever disclose things to them, but they know the secrets of the heart without them having been told. So I think that my children know more than anything.
You give a lot of credence to your friendship with Connie Mae Fowler. What exactly does she bring to the friendship that's been important to you?
Just an honesty and a humor. And, you know, an ability to gossip late night. And it is important in my life that I have people who don't care if I write, who really could care, who could care less if I wrote or worked at the Pepsi bottling plant. And Connie Mae and I, when we get together, it has nothing to do with writing. And as I grow older, and as the books have more success, particularly since Oprah, I guess I'm a little shocked at how many people do want to glom on or have some association just because I write or have been fortunate in some ways, and I run from these people. You know, they give me, you know, I'm going to end up one day with ulcerative colitis or something awful, irritable bowel syndrome. I just get a horrible knot in my stomach when I detect it coming on. And then I run. I hide. I will physically hide from people. So if someone doesn't wish me well and my children well, and they have to, I just don't want to have anything to do with them.
Why don't you begin by opening up the story you told in Ellen Foster a little bit for us, and then give us a reading from your new book,
okay,
if you would, Kay?
I'll be happy to.
Just tell us a bit about the first book.
I was a student at UNC Chapel Hill with Lewis Rubin studying literature because I still don't believe in studying writing for me. Other people, it works out perfectly well. If I studied it or taught it, I think I'd be arrested for assault and battery, or just for being rude, or passive aggressive. So I was studying literature, and we read the introduction to James Weldon Johnson's Book of American Negro Poetry, and he said exactly what I'd learned from Madame Bovary when I was 10 years old, and I'd never heard anyone else say it. And it perfectly encapsulates how anyone, Roddy Doyle and Patty Clark, ha ha ha, why that is lasting literature. And he's not writing from the point of view of an upper middle class white man or from a dead aristocrat. Why is his everyday quotidian voice lasting? And James Weldon Johnson said that at the turn of the century, it was the task of the American Negro poet, as he put it, to use his or her own language, just everyday language, to express the highest aspirations of mankind and do nothing less. So if I did something less as a Southerner, it would be, I would be writing about hairdos, sweet teas, barbecue, and beauty shops. And I didn't want to do that. I was too ruthlessly ambitious. I wanted to cut right to that Welty, Walker Percy, Faulkner plateau, because I thought if this is worth doing, it's worth doing extremely well. And I think after he said that what a writer in the South has to do is load each word with symbols from within, metaphor and symbol and image rather than symbols from without. So I didn't need all of these tacky phonetic spellings. I didn't need to say, you know, write as R-I-T-E or ain't. You know, I could talk because I've never spoken like that. I could use my own voice and just talk about love, hope, honor, peace, grief, sex, lust, love. And once I realized that, I began writing Alan Foster. And I gave it to Lewis Rubin, who was at Algonquin then. And although I didn't know it, he was my literature teacher, to read because I knew he would tell me the truth if it was any good. And he did. And he sent me home to write it. And I wrote it in 6 weeks because I thought he wanted it back like a term paper. You know.
That's wonderful.
Good things happen out of ignorance sometimes.
And I'd like you to read now, if you would, please. And for those of you who have just joined us, this is Jim Schumach with Between the Covers. My guest today, Kay Gibbons, and she'll be reading from The Life All Around Me by Ellen Foster.
Going on to the brief narration of my background section, I need to let you know not to read mine and think this girl is trying to create a mood of shock and sympathy to gain a free ride or discount. The summary is that my mother became too sad and died when I was 9, and ordinary life got and stayed unusual for the 2 years it took to track down the steady foster situation I still enjoy here. Things in between include moving out of the house due to my father's problems and then his death due to a sudden head vein explosion the next year, living with an aunt who didn't have raising another girl in mind, living with my art teacher, and then getting moved out of there because of judicial branch confusion, getting assigned to live with my grandmother, who soon sickened, lingered, and died, loving school as well as close friends throughout, reading like a fiend, having to move out of another house on Christmas, and walking up the road to the house of girls run by a foster lady, thus my name, Ellen Foster. If I had the job of selecting a well-rounded group of individuals to come to my college, I would worry about an underage orphan with a list of obstacles showing up and being a misfit. But I want to emphasize that I get along well both at school and at home. My foster mother is not pleased with my educational outlook and has tried to correct it on this end. But the private school here is the Academy of the New Dawn Apocalypse. And the school board said forced busing was enough upheaval, so they cannot allow students to bend the rules or skip grades or change schools unless a person needs braille material or rails. When I asked her about Harvard, she said she'd seen college careers pan out for several mathematical and piano prodigies on public television, so nothing would be lost by me giving it a try, with only offering more general skills of the mind. I realize it could not be more expensive, which is why I need to emphasize that I know how to work and don't mind it. On a typical morning at Harvard, for example, I could put in a few hours at the cafeteria working the breakfast tray line or at the gym handing out baskets, although I have more experience in the library. I've been trained in all areas, from ordering from the State Depository to changing bulletin boards, and worked in there alone for the 3 months of the librarian's knee surgery and malpractice case. And as she is now wheelchair-bound, and so much of a library involves reaching, I catch her up on a range of her daily duties. If you don't have the Dewey Decimal System, I'd quickly adapt to your procedure. There's also the school store and canteen, and I've worked in the concession stand at high school sports games and during a series of wrestling extravaganzas in town and Billy Graham crusade shows. Besides the current weekend jobs and home and church cleaning and magazine sales, I collect and write the school news, which runs each Saturday. It pays next to nothing, although everybody says the savings I can put toward Harvard from the cleaning, the food service, and the magazines would pay for an ordinary education, if that's what I was after. I enclosed a copy of my column, Ellen's Tellin', to check on the possibility of getting on at the paper up there. One last idea is although I understand Harvard doesn't have a special education section, I wanted to let you know that I could substitute teach in the neighborhood for all types of unruly people based on my experience monitoring special students during their teacher's rest period. Overall, it wouldn't be a problem for me to put in 40 hours a week and also maintain top grades and participate in some extracurriculars such as intellectual clubs, debating leagues, and public speaking. I've been able to compete in speaking and would like to continue. Enclosed is the essay from the 1974 Woodman of the World Youth Speaking Contest, which won in my state and then in Washington, entitled Franklin Delano Roosevelt, King Arthur or Robin Hood. There was so much to send, I decided not to send the other one, that one with the medical auxiliary entitled Marie Curie, Madam and Mother. But I went ahead and enclosed The Cell Wall and the Surface of Hemingway's Stories, a compare and contrast, which won a scholarship to the humanities programs at Johns Hopkins. In closing, I hope everything helps show that I wouldn't be a fade-out or a person who turns to drink or dope when things become tough. I believe that anything is possible if you have the combination of love for what you're doing and the will to sit down and not get up until it's done. I realize the amount of work ahead and the cost, and even though the only scholarship plan I know about at this time is the one sponsored by the United Negro College Fund, which I am not eligible for with just the problem of being this young, I do have a mind, which we all agree is a terrible thing to waste. Your friend, Ellen Foster.
Thanks for reading that, Kay.
Thank you.
Of course, this book begins with a letter to Derek Bok, then the president of Harvard, which is, it's her desire to skip high school and go on to Harvard.
Exactly. She thinks it's time, and with a kind of very iconoclastic life she's had so far and created for herself, it doesn't seem unusual. She hasn't had anyone come along in her life yet, besides her aunts, who inform her that this is unusual. But what in writing a series, in The Life All Around Me isn't so much a sequel as the first in a series about her life, kind of a portrait in novels. She's going to meet people later on and at Harvard who don't look at her contrast as a positive thing. So it'll be interesting to see how she handles those fools.
One thing I really love about Ellen is the openness of her mind. It portrays once again how it often is we ourselves who put the controls on our creativity.
It is, and I think that, you know, she would, I'm not quite sure what she's going to do when she grows up, but I think it can be anything artistic. Because she is capable of, you know, who was it, Byron or Keats saying, holding two contraries, you know, simultaneously, and honoring them both, studying and exploring them both.
For Between the Covers, this is Jim Schumach, my guest today, novelist Kay Gibbons. Her current work, The Life Around Me by Ellen Foster, has just been published by Harcourt. It's been great having you drive by this morning, Kay.
Thank you. No, thank you. This meant a lot to me. That was a good question. They were all good, but that was a good one. Thank you.
By day, give thanks. By night, beware. Half the world in sweetness, the other in fear. When the darkness takes you with her hand across your face, don't give in too quickly. Find the thing she's erased. Find the line, find the shape through the grain. Find the outline and things will tell you their name. The table.
tuned to KBOO Community Radio, 90.7 FM. Still to come on the radio zine at 10 o'clock, Terry Wiley of Oregon Tradeswomen discusses how that organization helps promote success for women in the trades. Also, Dan Denver of the Portland Central American Solidarity Committee talks about NAFTA-style free trade and immigrant rights. And at 10:30 on stage and studio, members of Artist Repertory Theater discuss Assassins by Stephen Sondheim.